Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. Today, it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Suzanne Chabot. Suzanne Chabot is both a registered professional nurse and licensed marriage family therapist. Most of her clinical experience has been in mental and community health. For Suzanne, the most rewarding time as a nurse has been working with inpatient psychiatric patients battling eating disorders, as well as managing a clinic providing care to high-need populations, including refugees from a variety of nations. As a therapist, Suzanne sees couples and adults. She has worked with a wide range of clientele from both Manhattan and Central New York. Her areas of expertise also include relationship difficulties, navigating life cycle transitions, eating disorders, and anxiety. Suzanne works collaboratively with her clients, utilizing somatic therapy techniques and narrative therapy as her foundation, while also interweaving from the models of dialectical behavioral therapy, attachment theory, and the Gottman method. And with that, Suzanne, welcome again to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. It's great to have you as a guest again.
Thank you. It is my pleasure, as always.
And we've reached a monumental point in the history of this podcast. You are on for a third time. So this is hockey's version of a hat trick in the podcast industry. So you are my first three-time guest. And I know today we're going to navigate the world of couples therapy and chronic illness. I know that's one of the things that you've dealt with in your private practice. The last time we talked, you were transitioning your private practice from part-time to full-time. And I wanted to just find out from you, how has that gone? How's the transition been? And what have you discovered so far?
Oh, yes. Thank you. Yes. January, I left the hospital and the security of benefits and a consistent paycheck. And I made the right choice. I'm happy about that. I've been doing very well as far as just like meeting goals to support myself and my family. I think that the first hurdle was, I compare it to how I envision what retiring would feel like, because I'm my own boss, I'm making my own schedule, and it felt like really unanchoring. And I had to root myself and try to find a schedule while still being spontaneous or just trying to be more independent. So that's been up and down, especially with the summer, but it's been okay. Been good. I feel like I'm getting new roots and I'm grounding myself in that way. And then also just trying to tap into different things that I can do socially, because that's something that has sort of been removed because the socializing with coworkers at the hospital and things like that. So things like this with you. Earlier today, I met with a colleague for coffee to try to know some people in the area to connect with. Things like that. I have to take the initiative to do it more.
Yeah. I think when you're your own boss, it's empowering because you can set your schedule, you can set the parameters, you can set your individual business goals, career goals, personal, professional goals, whatever goes into a part of that business plan. But at the same time, you got to take the initiative. You're your own boss and you have to get out there and do whatever networking or marketing you need to do to get the word out there and to make sure that people know what your services are and the quality services that you provide. Everything is on you, but yet it's very empowering. But at the same time, I can imagine it can be pretty daunting too.
There's a lot of moving parts. So you have to learn about being more business savvy and like the financial part, which is not my language. I'm always doing continuing education and trying to insert that into my schedule and the social part and just self-care. It's a lot of navigation and some shifting. And what I used to be more lenient in certain areas because I didn't have to be as stringent because I had that flexibility with my other paychecks, but going well overall.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. And I've referred clients to you over the years too, and they've been very happy with your services. And for sure, you're going to have one advocate with me. And certainly I will refer individuals to you that I believe you'll be a good fit for and vice versa. One of the things that I know that we've talked about is your work with couples and chronic illness. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about the nature of that work? Is it with couples whose partner is experiencing chronic illness, a family member who's experiencing chronic illness? So tell us a little bit about kind of the demographics of that group that you work with.
Yeah. So I think first it's good to just define what chronic illness is, because I think that people might have an idea, but it really can be far-reaching. Foundationally, the CDC defines chronic illness as any sort of disease process or condition that lasts 1 year or longer that requires treatment. So that can be, I'm not going to list out every single one because I think that would take up the entire time for the podcast, but cancer, renal or kidney disease, diabetes, addiction would qualify. Multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, pulmonary disease like COPD, cystic fibrosis. That runs the gamut too. So a lot of these illnesses can start off in childhood and somebody could have them into their adulthood and then meet somebody. Or it could be something that's diagnosed well into adulthood or as people age. And it also impacts mental health in both directions, I would say. Keeping that in mind, I would also add eating disorders to that list, just because I work with a lot of clients with eating disorders that struggle with that. So whether or not I see a couple or an individual, I think that I'm dealing with some sort of relationship dynamic that can impact how they navigate whatever it is, the stress of whatever condition they have with usually their partner, but it can also be a parent or it can be a child, something like that.
Is your strategy working with couples with chronic illness different depending on which family member is affected or the relationship dynamics are going on? Take us through maybe a couple of different options that you would entertain for couples, depending on the scenario that they're dealing with.
So I can give certain scenarios. Let's see. The first would be, so primarily we're talking about couples for this conversation. Two big ones I would want to mention are something that is more maybe physical. So we can go with Parkinson's. So somebody that's diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and they come in as a couple to deal with the stressors and the shifts in behavior of the person that has the condition. That person might not be, how can I explain this? So it might not be the actual condition itself, right? Like I've seen where there are side effects of the medication or the treatment that can then lead to a shift in behavior. And then that will then challenge the relationship dynamics. So I've seen circumstances like that. So it could be actually helping the disease process or shortening like how it's like progressing. But then like certain medications with Parkinson's, for example, can lead to manic type of behaviors or impulsive type of like over shopping or doing things that are a little bit more riskier. And that can really then impact the relationship. So people can come in to navigate that. So you're dealing with coping with the disease process and all the things that come at you as far as symbolic grief, which we've talked about before, but like the change in somebody's role within the relationship. Now you have maybe somebody that's more of a caretaker and somebody is more of a patient, and how that impacts the two of them. How comfortable are they about talking about how they're feeling about everything? sometimes people are more tight-lipped because they're afraid that the person that is sick is going, they don't want to make them feel worse or vice versa. So there might be the need for more vulnerability and communication about how they're feeling in a balanced way. And then dealing with something like the side effects and how behaviorally, how can they deal with something that might not be totally in their control? Most of it is not. So that's one example. It's hard to make everything concise. Another one, I wanted to touch upon this too, probably later on, but with addiction. People don't typically think of this unless they've experienced it, but you might fall into a relationship with somebody that is actively in the throes of an addiction. And then 10, 20 years later, they decide to go through recovery. And then there's that shift in the relationship. So sometimes chronic illness can present as problematic when somebody is actually in recovery. And there's a change in the dynamics at that point that's actually healthy, but then it causes disruption in the homeostasis and what they're used to. And that can be problematic too. So I've seen that as well. So those are two examples. With people that are not in a romantic partnership, I've worked with individual clients that struggle with aging parents or patients that are going through dementia and being caretakers for them. Mm-hmm. I'm navigating that with them. Children, like parents of adult children that have addiction. That's another one, even though that's, I think when people think of chronic illness, they're not thinking of addiction, but it's under the umbrella.
It sure is. It meets all the parameters of chronic illness. It's progressive and it's fatal if not treated, but it does meet those parameters. I also imagine, I know you mentioned the symbolic grief piece, because especially when chronic illness enters the equation, the dynamics of the relationship change. The individuals who were once, let's say, husband and wife, if you're looking at a heteronormal relationship or same-sex relationship, that role has changed. It's just now, it's, one of them becomes a caretaker. So they lose a big part of the relationship that defined them. You also mentioned, too, in terms of some of the behavioral side effects of the medication, how much do caretakers blame themselves or think they are the cause of those behavioral changes?
I have not really seen that specific problem play out in my office. The thought that comes to mind with that question is, what narrative probably plays out the most is managing what they do so as to not upset the person or to make it worse or whatever the case may be, to control something they can't really control, which is the other person and like how they're doing. And what that typically will do then will put up a wall or a barrier to connection between the two of them. So a big part of coping, like relational coping, is to be able to have open communication about emotions or fears or things that are vulnerable. And typically the fear of, am I going to upset this person or make it worse? Within reason, because communication or what they decide to talk about or do together should be balanced. It shouldn't be all about totally consuming just this topic of their medical condition, because then that's not healthy either.
So essentially, you'll also help them achieve some type of a balance, some type of like normalization of talking about just everyday things and balancing that with the issues that are related to chronic illness, either in the other partner or in the family member. How much normalization is involved with it? I imagine some couples come in feeling real guilty, especially when somebody has chronic illness, guilty about just, geez, maybe I should have spent more time with them. Maybe I should have been more attentive. What do you do to normalize that for them? First of all, is that a normal part of the process of chronic illness, feeling that type of guilt and regret?
Yeah, I think the symbolic grief and the normalization of, I guess what I label as taboo emotions, because they're emotions that people don't want to share because they have some sort of guilt or there's some sort of shame or narrative associated with it that like we should not be feeling X, Y, or Z. And so people don't speak to them. So that's intertwined with a symbolic grief. So things like what their roles are, shifts in power, and then that can then flip into how this can affect our sexual chemistry or in our intimacy. Because when you end up being like the power dynamic shifts, or you start to view somebody as a patient and less like a partner, that can spill over. And then you're not having the conversations. The loss of what could be, of dreams, what you hope the relationship would be. There is always the potential of burnout and resentment. And if it's not processed, not necessarily with the partner, maybe with a counselor or support group or vice versa, both people could be feeling resentment and anger. And if it's not really processed in a way where it's heard or witnessed, then it could probably come out as irritability or anger towards the other person.
Yep.
Through this other vessel that's not helpful, again, for the relationship. A lot of research talks about dyadic coping, which means how a couple copes together in the setting of the chronic illness. So there is that balance. You mentioned balance. Balance is like the word for this, because you need the balance of the couple coping together, but then you also, independent of one another, they also need to cope.
And I've always said that the best relationships are those that are forged together, but also when individuals in the relationship can feel free to develop their own experiences, bring those back into the relationship and talk about that, which I think makes the relationship more full, more stronger, and just more rich in general. Thing with emotions, and I've got to ask you this in terms of a couple's concept, and we've talked about this before, how men and women or individuals who are male-aligned, female-aligned, express emotions much more differently.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that? I want to preface this by saying that for many men, and not all men, but for many men, we don't have a vocabulary that includes emotions, because emotions are perceived as threatening. We have, it makes us more vulnerable. It does not align with the suck it up and take care of everybody else narrative. So when, let's say, looking at a heteronormal relationship, you have a female relationship says, my husband or my partner, my significant other won't talk about their feelings. How do you proceed with that, particularly when you're talking about enhancing communication in very challenging situations?
Okay. This is hard. And I think you're right, as far as men, it's harder, but also with just, I think, humans, especially in our culture, it's really challenging to be able to even identify what it is you're feeling and what's happening in the moment of higher stress or conflict, or when somebody's really physiologically reactive. So the first thing that comes to mind is tapping into the body and taking it out of the cerebral state, which we focus in on all the time. Most people, and bringing it down a few inches, and sometimes being able to just do a body scan and to take note of what is going on in our body. And then after just taking note of that, saying, okay, have you ever had that physical sensation before in the past, or at another moment in time when you knew what you were feeling? And then you can connect that emotion to that physical sensation. So that's one way that can help somebody ease into what could I potentially be feeling. Another thing I do with couples is when, especially if they're engaged in a dialogue, I do different types of dialogues with couples if they're willing to do so. And it slows down the conversation and helps them really hear each other without being too hyper-focused on responding and defending themselves. They're really able to just sit with the other person. And more often than not, if it's a heterosexual couple, the man will have a harder time being more expressive and the woman will be much more verbose. And to help ease along and pull out more information, I'll give what I call sentence stems, which I think was coined in Imago therapy, or that's where I learned it. I might say something like, they might be processing something that happened before they walked in the room. And he might say, I might just start very simply with, I felt, what emotion did you feel? Like, just prompt them about that. And I always call these are like the safe emotions. Annoyed and frustrated are like the safe emotion. Mm-hmm. So I'm not somebody that will just let that slide. There's more underneath that. So I would give a sentence stem of, okay, there was a time during my childhood that I felt frustrated in this way. Oh, and an example of that would be, and that can be difficult to pull from, but it's just an example of a sentence stem. And what that can do is, especially, not only can it bring up certain examples where there was a similar type of feeling in their body or a similar dynamic playing out with somebody else from their past, that takes the heat off of their partner. So their partner can then understand this is something that maybe it's a pattern, most likely was a pattern that started off in their youth. And they're not the ones being to blame right now. They're just trying to understand what was going on with their partner in that moment. And maybe they have some fears associated with something in the past. So that can help them really hear that person more. Or another sentence stem could be, I'm really worried that if you don't sober up, X will happen. Right. So to follow through a thought, a catastrophic thought, rather than just being frustrated.
And I like that you reframe those emotions in the context of sentence stems, because I think with a lot of men, if you ask a man what they're thinking, they'll be able to tell you very easily what they're thinking, because many men are in their heads anyway. We're problem solvers, and we problem solve cognitively.
Yeah.
So if you ask me, Dave, what did you feel about such? And I said, boy, Suzanne, I think this really sucked. Mm-hmm. And so you might reframe that into a sentence stem, and then from there it turns into a feeling. So I think for guys, you can get to feelings, but you got to do it in a more backdoor way through trying to figure out what their mindset is.
Yes, and you know what? If I said, Dave, that was a thought, so what did you feel? And then you might come back and say, I felt like blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And the word like is after feel, what usually follows is a thought or a judgment, not a feeling. That's so right. I tell people, you cannot say like after feel.
Yeah. Exactly. Because I would
it's
just
hard.
Say, I felt angry. I felt frustrated. I felt demoralized. And so when the feeling in the context of a sentence, whereas I'll interpret it a thought, it's going to help me, I think, get to those more threatening feelings. Than if you just try to just get to it without taking that additional step. So I think that's a great technique, and it's very simple in its application, but yet very powerful in terms of the paradigm shift that it can create.
Yeah. And I think too, with emotions and vulnerability and like a shift in roles, there might be this narrative or this idea that the person that's sick can't be there for the person that's the caretaker. But actually, that's one of the best things for the person that is now has this thing that's attached to them and is part of them now, that they actually can still probably have a lot of ways that they can support or be there for their partner that might not have been those same ways they used to be, but that can be very healing and it can be very empowering for them. And it's a healthy distraction. Like, I still have this strength. I can still be there for my partner. They're not entirely my caregiver, right? We still are able to be a team in this way. We're able to cope together in this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's really key, because anytime any type of chronic illness or other challenge comes in that really reverses or changes the relationship dynamic or the family dynamic, I think there's a couple of different choices. We can adjust and try to find meaning and to establish and reestablish communication in spite of that, or particularly if there's been a history of prior dysfunction in that family, any type of chronic illness is just going to disintegrate the family communication structures, expression of feelings, boundaries, whatever else has been compromised. It will compromise that, I believe, even more. What specific coping strategies, in addition to the sentence stems, what are some other coping strategies, other ideas, other suggestions that you make to couples to get through the challenging circumstances presented by chronic illness?
So first, and this is as I'm speaking to these, you can apply it to each of them independent of one another to some degree, and then actually doing the together collaboratively, right? Dyadically, however you want to describe it. The first is, especially if, and this is also, I know we had talked a little bit about the timeline and like how long couples have been together. So this also, I was speaking generally, but there's ways to navigate it differently based on the couple and the scenario and the disease. But getting to know and educate yourself on whatever it is, the condition or the illness is, and being involved as appropriate, doing your own research, but then also being curious and asking your partner what it's like for them and asking if they want you to attend different appointments or not. So then you can also help if that's appropriate. If somebody is actively seeking recovery from addiction, to also maybe consider doing your own work and do your own 12-step work so that you can also work on yourself simultaneous to your partner working on themselves. So then you can understand if they're also working a 12-step program, you can also feel as though you understand what that is, that recovery process is. We talked about balanced communication, being open in a variety of ways. One, having the hard conversations, talking about fears, collaborative conversations about how to tackle this condition in a way that's more like empowering for the couple. And research shows that if couples are more successful at the dyadic coping or coping together, if they have a similar type of like narrative or belief system about whatever the disease is, and being aware of what caretaker burnout is and to try to prevent it. So that also goes back to taking care of yourself, seeking the support you need for yourself so you don't necessarily overdo it with utilizing your partner for support. That is a balancing act. Finding support groups, your own counseling and or couples counseling, and acknowledging the strengths that you have one another and also your relationship. And like bringing that out into fruition, like speaking to it, sharing appreciations. Because a lot of times, even without outside of chronic illness, couples will usually take note of things they appreciate, and then the moment will pass by and they will not speak to it. And so the other person is not really aware, or it's not something that's cultivated. And that's really important too.
Yeah, I think it's important to cultivate gratitude and appreciation even in the worst of circumstances, because I've told my students, I've told anybody else who will listen to me, is that you can have the worst day in the world, but you can always find something to be grateful for. So sit down and even in your worst day, pick out one thing that you were grateful for that happened. It might have been somebody held the door open for you, somebody smiled at you, somebody just had something nice to say about a class that you did, or just about a kindness that you gave to a relative that you hadn't even been aware of because it was several years out of your memory. I also like the collaborative aspect in terms of involving the individual with chronic illness into the decision-making in terms of what appointments do they want my caretaker to go to? How are they feeling today? What do you need for me to do for you? Because what that does is it plays into the strengths and the capabilities that they already have. And chronic illness is disempowering to begin with. So any ways that I think that we can teach couples to empower either their family member or empower the other partner who's experiencing the chronic illness, the more, for lack of a better word, tolerable and manageable it'll be. The other thing that's important, I think, too, if chronic illness does accelerate to the point where there's no longer treatment and death is end of life chapters around the corner, one of the things I've always felt is that it's also important to get relief for a caretaker during those times, because during that end of life chapter, they're not only focused on caretaking, but they're also focused on now their own anticipatory grief, which can become very intensified, particularly as that person gets closer to the moment of transition. I imagine you really stress with a couple to find respite care services or get some additional support, particularly during end-of-life chapters.
I actually have not had that scenario happen, other than probably the dementia part or the dyad, which is usually tends to be a parent and a child. And sometimes, thinking of just for me as a therapist, even getting to the point of acceptance that is something that is around the corner is in and of itself the challenge. That there's a lot of denial and stoicism and unwillingness to acknowledge that. That's been a big roadblock for me with the couples that I've seen.
Now, let's say, for example, in the event of, we know chronic illness, any chronic illness, whether it's addiction, cancer, it affects the family as well, too. So if you have a couple with children, I'm sure there's some different types of dyads that you will put together. If it involves the whole family, will there be times where you might, let's say, do a parent and child, do the chronically ill individual with the child or with children? Are there circumstances where you might do some segmenting of the family system and just work with different parts of that?
I've offered it. And most times people don't take me up on that offer. So they might even just stay as a couple, or I've had scenarios where a couple actually decides that they don't want to continue couples therapy, but then usually it's the client with the chronic illness that will stay. And then they will be navigating how they're coping and their different relationships and how they're relating and dealing with each relationship themselves. Yeah. There's like the ideal scenarios, and a lot of times they don't play out that way. So I've learned and continue to learn to just accept where people are and not push them where they don't want to go or if they're not ready, even though I know that's probably the healthiest way that they would, the path they could take. And it's also more and more just experientially knowing that people could sit here and say, oh, if this was presented to me, this is exactly how I would navigate it. And then when it is, that's not at all how they behave. We can't predict it. It reminds me of David Kessler, who's more experienced and in the know about grief. And then he speaks to losing his son and how he was just like very avoidant and froze for a while as far as working through his grief and the way that he would really educate and support others to do. And so he himself is a good example of somebody that just, you can't predict how you'll be. It doesn't matter how much or what you feel like you should or shouldn't do. Maybe you felt that way too, I'm sure, in different circumstances.
I've just turned 69 years old, and I've been no stranger to grief. And every loss that I've experienced is fresh. It doesn't matter what I knew from previous losses. It doesn't matter that I came to acceptance of the fact that my world was different without the physical presence of my prior loved ones. Every loss puts you right back to square one. You go through the process of grief, and you need to do that. It's just, you can't sidestep anything. You need to go through that process. You need to grieve the relationship. You need to experience all of the emotion that goes with it before you can move through it. I think what's different for me now, in the 21 years since my daughter, Janine, transitioned, is that with every new loss, I still grieve in the human experience while trying to look for a sacred law reason that could account for what's happened. So my head is, I live in two different worlds at once, the world of grief and the world of trying to find greater meaning while I'm grieving. Before that wouldn't have happened. That would not have happened at all. And I think it's the same. For, like you said, if a couple is dealing with a chronic illness of one family member and it happens again, they're gonna go through the same emotions, the same process, the same restructuring, the same questions. And you need to, in order to get through it. Every situation is different.
And you still can't predict because one is could be different, much more different than the other. This past year, one of my childhood friends, best friends during childhood, who I haven't really been in touch with for years, passed away. And I ended up giving her eulogy. And the entire week, I was like a wreck. And I would have never predicted how emotional I was, just crying like for 3 days straight. Mm-hmm. So you can't predict how you will be and how you show up and how difficult it might. Another, not to bring up David Kessler again, but I love a lot of his sayings and like when people ask certain questions that pop up a lot. And I like to apply grief to something like this. And one of the questions that people ask him a lot is, what type of grief is the worst? And his answer is yours. And so I feel like you can apply that to this. What type of chronic illness is the worst? Or is it worse for couples that are newly together or a couple that has been married for 50 years? Then I think you could probably say the chronic illness that's the worst is the one that you're dealing with now. Wow. Like it's for you to define because you don't know. And there's so many meanings attached to different illnesses. And how much are you invested in the relationship?
Yep.
How did you find out about the chronic illness? What would be the difference between a couple that has been together longer than a newly paired couple or a new diagnosis versus a diagnosis that's been there all along? And there are five questions that I said I felt were really important. The one is, how invested is the couple in one another? Because you could be a brand new couple and be really invested in one another and stick it out with a new diagnosis. And then you could be married for 30 years and be very resentful towards one another and easily check out how the chronic illness was disclosed. So it could be, and also I would pair that with, what is the actual illness and what are the beliefs and narratives surrounding that illness also? Because it could be something like HIV or an addiction, or it could be something like kidney disease, right? Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a taboo attached to something like HIV. And there's going to be a taboo attached to something like addiction. There's going to be judgment, right? It's going to be laced with all this stuff that might impact how somebody responds or if it comes out because it was a hidden secret. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of nuances. Was the illness from childhood or was it diagnosed later in life? If somebody has been dealing with diabetes their entire life, more their own, they're very probably independent and able to care for themselves, probably for the majority of the time in their lifespan, versus if it's a fresh diagnosis later in their life, then it becomes more of like a we diagnosis and we're dealing with this more together. And then and then the other thing I wrote down, what we already touched on, was sometimes getting better with a chronic illness is what really stirs up and screws up with the homeostasis and can cause problems.
And I think particularly if the person's been used to being a caregiver for all those years and all of a sudden that's taken away from them, the family system has to rebalance around that now. And they may also symbolically grieve the loss of that role because it gave them meaning and it gave them purpose.
So exactly.
How do I find purpose again now that the chronic illness has become in remission?
Yeah. And how dare I feel that way? How dare I feel upset that they're sober? I've wanted this my whole life. And now what am I doing with myself?
Yeah.
Who am I?
And I think it's also important to normalize that. That's a normal part of the whole process in terms of how do I deal with this now? Why am I so resentful? And I think normalization plus education lays a groundwork for some really effective therapy to occur. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say what rides along with the normalization is just non-judgmental space. When people come in and inviting them and speaking to the fact that these are normal emotions and we tend to judge ourselves for them. And it's not something to be judged or ashamed of. It's part of the human experience.
If there's one thing today that you want to leave our listeners with, Suzanne, what would that be?
I think the two words are balance and connection.
And specifically as that relates to families or couples who are dealing with chronic illness, those are two big buzzwords.
Yeah. I would say, I don't want to be like, I want to be as concise as possible, but like with both balance and connection, it's like internally, the balance inside of yourselves, within, and then between. So being able to take care of yourself, to be balanced, right? And then relationally, how are you balanced and how are you connecting?
Makes sense, because if we don't put a priority in self-care, we can't take care of anybody else's needs, or we can't be available for those who need us. And a lot of times in this very hectic and polarized world that we live in, our own self-care needs sometimes are lower on the priority list than they should be, let's put it that way. So if people want to get in touch with you, want to find out more about your services, want to enlist you as a therapist, what's the best way for them to do that?
I invite everybody to go to my website, which is heartinhandtherapy.com, H-E-A-R-T, inhandtherapy.com.
I'll make sure that's in the program notes, along with the links to the other two episodes that we did. I think one was on symbolic grief and the other was on reincarnation and past life experiences. So with that, Suzanne, thanks so much for, again, being a valuable guest contributor to the Teaching Journeys podcast. As always, it's a pleasure having a conversation with you.
Always a joy. Now we got to come up with a fourth one.
Yeah, yes, we do. We have to do the hat trick plus one now. We'll figure out something, I'm sure.
Yes.
We'll figure out, even if it's a topic nobody's explored before, we'll figure it out. So
yeah, that's the best.
Oh yeah. Something that's never been done before. Mm-hmm. So that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.